This is In Focus, the weekly public affairs program from KTBB and the Team Sports Radio, featuring members of the local community working to make East Texas a better place.
Welcome to In Focus for this weekend of April 11th, 2026. I'm Paul Gleiser, owner and general manager of KTBB Radio, and I'm pleased to have as my guest the gentleman from Texas, Representative Nathaniel Moran from the 1st District of Texas. Congressman, welcome.
Thanks, Paul. It's great to be here with you. I know we've got lots of important things to talk about, and I so appreciate you giving me the opportunity to have an extended conversation. It's nice to be able to work down in detail on some of these issues because they're tough issues we're dealing with in D.C.
There are so many tough issues. What I have my list here. Where do we start? There's a war on. Earlier this week, you objected publicly to some of the rhetoric from President Trump regarding that war. Fill us in on that.
Yeah, you know, I'm not one to do a lot of posting on social media, and certainly I understand that the president is prone to hyperbole. I know that. And I tell people all the time that your first response should not be to react. But there are moments when I think we need to be very clear about who we are as Americans and the principles that we stand for. In this moment, when I saw his tweet about destroying a whole civilization, you know, that to me was something that I felt like needed to be responded to. And I wanted to be sure that the folks in East Texas knew what my position was. And my position clearly is, look, what makes America great is the moral foundation and the basis of what we do and how we go about doing those things, particularly in war. When you're in a battle, a conflict, it's not just the objective that needs to be moral and just, but it needs to be how you achieve that objective. And I thought the president's tweet went beyond that. And I believe that our constituents here in East Texas deserve to hear me say that is not consistent with my values. I don't think it's consistent with their values. And frankly, I didn't think it was consistent with American longstanding values.
Did you hear anything from the White House after you spoke out?
No, I didn't. And one of the things I was proud about the statement was, I mean, most people that know me, if they follow me, they know I'm a defense hawk. I mean, I'm all about very strong strategic military action that is in the national security interest of the United States. And I supported the president's efforts towards taking out Iran's ability to harm Americans abroad and here and taking out their nuclear capabilities. I'm very much in favor of that. But I think there has to be a line that's drawn. But when we actually wrote that statement and went over it several times and made several corrections and edits to my own work before we published it out, we never attacked the president, never did that, never called for impeachment. People out there trying to politicize this stuff, that kind of stuff is all political rhetoric, and we weren't going to lean into that. What we wanted to do was actually talk about the principles that make America great in the past, today, and that will keep America great in the future, and that transcends any person or any political party.
Let me ask you this. Let me test this theory of mine with respect to the president initiating this military action against Iran. His critics are saying he's a cowboy, he's flexing his ego, he's flown off the handle. I mean, his critics are just all over the place trying to deflect attention from other vulnerabilities that he has politically. Go down the list. I believe this, and you can agree or disagree. I'm interested in your take. The man's not stupid. He is counting on a strong economy, a reduction in inflation, low gasoline prices, people feeling good about their wallets. He's counting on that in the critical midterms that are going to determine whether the last half of his second term is a productive last half or just miserable if the Democrats retake the House. And he launched the war anyway. That tells me that he was convinced not launching the war came at a greater cost. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with that. And he is very astute when it comes to the national security interests of the United States and the threats that are posed out there. I am so thankful that he has restored strength into the White House and the things that he's done to, frankly, push China back into a box. Whereas in the prior couple of decades, China systematically had been putting the United States in a box. They had begun to develop relationships in South America and Central America and in Africa and even even in Europe, where they were pushing the United States back and where they were isolated. Now we've pushed back. We've hammered on one of their biggest allies in South America, Venezuela. We've gotten after another big ally of theirs in the Middle East, Iran. I anticipate before this is all said and done, before his presidency is over, he's going to push back on Putin harder than he has already to date. I think he's working to that point. All of that actually is pushing back on China. A lot of it are proxy conflicts with China. Now, the one in Iran, there was specific information that some of it's public, some of it's not, about the threat that they posed. And the first operation last year that took out a lot of their nuclear facilities, that was great. But, you know, there's still 441 kilograms of enriched uranium that's out there. That's enough for like 9 bombs.
9 or 11. I keep hearing some number like that.
But enough. I mean, one's too many for Iran, because they've already said their objective is either a death to America or a death to Israel. And I've said many times, I think Israel is the appetizer. America is the entree. It's the main course for Iran. That's who they want to get after. And they're going to do it either directly or indirectly through their proxies. And they've done that for decades now. And we've allowed them to build that strength up. And they've spread that hate across the region. We need to put them in the box. I think it's telling that many other countries in the Middle East region have actually come to our on our side and to our aid in this particular instance, because they know a nuclear Iran is bad for everybody.
We seem to have allies that we would not have at one time characterized as allies in this.
That's right.
And then there's some apparent friendships in the Middle East that didn't exist. So that tells you something has fundamentally changed, and that would be that perhaps Iran is being clearly seen as the threat that it is. That's what it says to me. It's certainly not what it says to the president's critics. His critics are they're talking impeachment.
I know. It's ridiculous, because their critics, a lot of their critics, really are suffering from this Trump derangement syndrome. And I think that's true. There's so many people out on the left that they do not want to admit when he does anything right. They're not going to want to give him credit. And they're certainly not going to want to admit it in light of the fact that he is he's taken a dichotomous approach than their predecessor, than Biden. Biden was so weak in office, and they defended him for so long on so many issues, the border and national security issues, and now we have a strong president that's actually getting results in a lot of ways. And yeah, his rhetoric at times goes too far, and most of the time I just don't comment on it. This week I did. I felt like I needed to comment on that, but he's getting results, and the results are really, really positive.
Yeah, you know, this show is a public affairs show, but people know my politics if they listen to this radio station, so I don't mind saying here on this show what I believe. I've listened to Donald Trump's words. I have objected to many of them, just as you have. I even went so far as to question when he was considering running in 2024, is that a good idea? Took a lot of heat for it, but I said, is this the guy that can win? Turns out he's a guy not going to win. He won decisively. So to the extent that I raised that question, I was put in my proper place. He was the guy. But I have quit listening to what he says and started focusing on what he does. And if you can just back off and be objective and say, is that a good result for most Americans? He's had a very successful presidency even so far.
He has. And I think he knows he needs to measure his success based on the impact of Americans' daily lives as well. And that's why I think this Iranian conflict will be short-lived, because he understands the high gas prices, the impact on the stock market, the coming 2026 fall election cycle, which, as you said, is really important for him, because it's either going to determine he has an effective 2 years of an administration or an effective 4 years of an administration. Because if we lose the House, he's going to face impeachment after impeachment after impeachment, inquiry, a subpoena, investigation. It's going to tie up the next 2 years. This is very critical in the midterm election to make sure we keep the House. We're definitely going to keep the Senate. The numbers, we'll see where that's going to be, but we're definitely going to keep the Senate above 50%.
Well, Speaker Mike Johnson was in town, what, week before last, correct? And you hosted an event in White House, a really great event. He was quite optimistic, and he made what I thought was a plausible case for how the Republicans could not only retain the House, but actually grow the majority. That flies in the face of conventional wisdom in politics, where the sitting president's party loses House seats in the first midterm. To what extent do you buy into the speaker's optimism?
Yeah, I'm an optimistic guy, so I certainly think that we can defy the statistics and the odds and the history of the midterms, and we can win this. There's no question about it, because when it comes down to it, it is really based on candidates at the local level. When you're talking House candidates, it matters the quality of the candidates you put up. It matters how much money those candidates have to get their message out in those. There's really about 31 districts, and that's something folks need to know, that of the 435 districts that are out there, there's only about 31 that are competitive anymore because of decades of redistricting, both Republican and Democrat, that have created safe Democratic seats and safe Republican seats. Now we only have about 31 that are really competitive in the middle, that are determined by the general election, and that determines the swing of who's going to actually hold the House in the fall. So those are the 31 seats we need to focus on.
That determines who has the gavel.
That's right.
Washington is so incredibly divided, and I think most Americans don't like it. I think most Americans, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, don't like it. You and I were at an event. I don't even remember what it was. In your first term, you were kind enough to invite me to an event, but I do remember this. Sitting behind us was one of your Democratic colleagues, and we had the most pleasant conversation and discussion with him. We were just people attending an event in an auditorium, and we all very well got along well, and we yucked up the fact that we're on either side of the aisle, and it was very pleasant. It doesn't look like it's that way from the outside to the average American watching what's going on in Washington. So where does the truth lie on that spectrum? Is it really as acrimonious as it appears from the outside?
It is not. It is not, except for just on a couple of issues. But it looks acrimonious on the public level because I think of the rise of social media, and the fact that people know that they have to either instill fear or hatred or frustration on folks to get them to follow them on social media, or say very outlandish things on social media to get more followers. That gives them, frankly, more influence. And every member of Congress, I think, either on the Republican or the Democratic side, ultimately is looking to find their path of influence, looking to find a way to be the louder voice for their constituents. And frankly, I mean, I'm trying to do that too for the people in East Texas. They deserve a loud voice in Washington, D.C. that is propagating and pushing the principles that are here in East Texas. Well, there's certain avenues you can take to do that. I've chosen a path of actually digging into the committee work and the policy work that is hard work, that takes a lot of hours, that's under kind of the backstage stuff. It's the things that most people don't see on social media. But there's a number of members of Congress that, frankly, aren't willing to do the work that it takes to have influence in that manner. So the easier path to influence for them is to say something outlandish on social media, or to do something that draws lots of attention to them because they've engaged in hyperbole or political rhetoric, or stirred up that hatred, that fear, that anger in their constituents. That's the easier way in their minds to get to influence, but I think that's illusory. I think it's short-lived. I think it's the wrong direction to go. It's not what the people of East Texas, I think, deserve. They deserve to have somebody sitting at the table doing the hard work like we did last year in the Ways and Means Committee. I've been privileged to be on that Ways and Means Committee the last 2 years. Be one of 26 Republicans sitting in that in a room for 4 months trying to figure out how are we going to lower taxes, lower regulations, and increase the liberty of families, farmers, and businesses in East Texas so that they can live out the American dream. That a working families tax cut will have more impact on the lives of Americans and East Texans than any other thing that's happened in the last decade or two. Hands down, no question about it, because it restored liberty, it reduced those taxes and those regulations. That's the kind of work and the result that I think East Texans want me to do in Washington, D.C. I think that's the way we ought to behave. But when the cameras aren't there, to your point, there's lots of collaboration and lots of relationship across the aisle, as it should be, because you need those votes to get things done, especially in the Senate when you got that 60-vote threshold.
Most Americans support the SAVE Act. It's something, you know, we call it an 80-20 issue, 70%, 80%, depending on which poll. But it's a high majority, which is to say that means both Republicans and Democrats, to get to that level of when you get to 80%, you got to have a bunch of Democrats with you want the SAVE Act, which is, to your way of thinking, my way of thinking, common sense. You want to know who's voting and are they eligible to vote.
That's right. It is common sense.
I mean, that seems pretty straightforward to me, yet we can't seem to get it done. Our representatives in Congress can't seem to get that for us. So let me take you to 30,000 feet. Is that a breakdown of representative government?
I don't think it's a breakdown of representative government. It is because truly those senators, I've got to believe those senators that are holding this up, they're holding it up because they're listening to their base. On the House side, same thing. Because if it's going to get them unelected, they're not going to do it. And so I think that they're listening to their base, primarily their primary base, and that's. You know, that's the thing that you have to think about is who are we listening to? I think I represent all of East Texas, all 800,000 people, and I want to listen to all 800,000 people, regardless of whether or not they're Republican or Democrat or independent or where they are in the spectrum of bright red or kind of different shades of red or bright blue or different shades of blue. I represent all of them. But guess what? The reality is that the election actually happens in the primary for me. And that's the way it is with a number of House seats as well. Back to this districting thing. So it pushes people to the edges. And what we need is more reasonable common sense approach. And this is a common sense approach right here. And I don't know for the life of me why some of those senators are just not willing to go down this path.
Let me ask you this. You know, if you listen to this radio station, if you listen to the talk shows that we have on the air, you'd be told, and believably so, that the Democratic Party, an awful lot of the money that funds Democratic campaigns comes from outside wealth, enormous wealth, billionaires like George Soros is the chief among them, that's really pushing the Democratic Party farther left than it might go otherwise. Do you believe that?
I don't know statistically. I haven't looked in depth about their money. I know that they had their, I think it's called Act Blue or something like that. It was their platform where they were receiving money. And that particular platform was not vetting the low dollar amounts coming through. And there was a lot of fraud through that. The DOJ has stopped that because we raised flags about that last session. But I don't know statistically where all their money's coming from. But what I can tell you is they're in an ideological battle on the left. They don't know who they are from an identity standpoint.
Well, what's pushing what is driving the extreme left?
Oh, it's their base. I don't think it's the money behind the Democratic Party that's pushing the ideological changes. I think it's the base themselves, because the Democrats for a long time have always been kind of this conglomeration of ideological pockets. So you had people that would basically say, look, I don't necessarily agree with your far left perspective on this particular issue, but I'm going to support you if you'll support me on this far left issue. And so it became this conglomeration of individual pockets of far left issues, whether or not it's LGBTQ or whether or not now, you know, we see stuff like men and women's sports or you're going to see
another 80-20 issue though.
Yeah, I know. It was kind of this unwritten agreement that if you're on the left, you had to agree with everybody else's left-leaning principles, even if necessarily it wasn't your bag of tricks. Well, that started moving everybody to the left where they had to embrace, just look in the last 15 years since Obama came into office, it is not the Democratic Party that it was under Clinton. Not at all. Completely different. Much different from an economic standpoint, much different from a social standpoint. A lot of it was driven by the rise, I think, of Bernie Sanders and then AOC and the people that got riled up behind them and started supporting them. Now they are a faction within the Democratic Party that is pushing primary opponents against sitting members of Congress that are Democrats. And before that was a big no-no. And they're trying to push people to the left. And even if you don't lose a primary in the Democratic election on those issues, you have to move yourself left on those issues to protect your left flank in order to win the primary. And that's why people on the left have moved further and further to the left.
Let's be be brutally honest, is the same thing happening to any degree on the right?
Yes, it is. And that's what I say about the redistricting stuff. Again, decades of it. We're not just talking about in the last year. Decades of it, both Republicans and Democrats have created these super majority districts for either Democrats or Republicans so that everybody can have safe seats. And then you end up with, as I mentioned, about 31 competitive seats in the nation that determine who holds sway of the House of Representatives. Well, that means that all 404 of the other seats are only ever listening politically to either the Republican base for their primary or the Democratic base for their primary. In our recent primary, we had 11% voter turnout. So I happen to think, again, that as an elected official, you should be representing and listening to everybody in your district. But from a political practical standpoint,
in order to remain employed,
to get elected, you really have to move the direction of your primary voters and the 10-11% that end up showing up in the primary election day.
An anecdote: you and I at the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee in 2024, we were having lunch, and a constituent came over, and she was extremely agitated about a single issue. And was unrelenting in challenging you on your answers. To what extent does that skew the process of getting things done in Washington?
What's needed is we need broad-based involvement by everybody in the electoral process. That's what we need. What I tell people all the time, since we're in a conservative area, this is a 75-77% Republican area, is one of the most conservative districts in the nation, probably one of the top five right now conservative districts out of 435 districts. I challenge them. I want them not to be kindergarten conservatives. Do not just listen to the surface talking points that are out there on social media, or don't just gravitate to the talking points that get them fearful or riled up or angry, but actually engage in the issues. I'm so proud that a lot of East Texans do that, that they get engaged in the issues, that they learn and they read. We put out a newsletter, almost 30,000 people get it every week in East Texas, that is not a campaign newsletter. It's just talking about the issues. And when there's a tough vote, we explain why we made the tough vote, and we provide a lot of context for it. I recently had somebody on a tough vote. He texted me later on and said, I was really angry when I heard you voted this certain way until I read the newsletter and understood why, and now I agree with you. And so that's the kind of thing that I want our East Texas constituents to do, is to say, I don't want to listen to the far left or far right news, but I actually want to investigate it myself and find out the facts behind the policies that are going through Congress and why certain votes are being taken. It matters. That depth of knowledge matters.
We got about 6 minutes left, and I want to end this on what I think will be a kind of an upbeat note. Let me throw this premise out at you, Congressman. In the same week, the United States of America, the only superpower on the planet, prosecuted a war with such surgical precision that it has crippled a malign regime with minimal impact on that regime's citizens. In fighting a war in a way that has never been done before, and sent human beings into space farther away from their home planet than has ever been done before. Both of them, I think, representative of a nation unlike any on Earth.
I agree.
And illustrative of the fact, something that I believe to my core, no nation in all of history has ever accumulated as much power as the United States and yet been so restrained in its use. Mm. Your thoughts?
Yeah, it's one of the key lessons about a power and authority that I think is hard for individuals, certainly hard for nation states. And we have, I think we've done it successfully, because generally when people get power, they want to use it inappropriately. They want to use it to restrict other people's freedoms. But we have a responsibility with our liberty. I'm very loud about that on the on the trail when I talk to folks is that the liberty that my job is to, I think, to provide liberty to folks in their daily lives. As a government official, I think spreading liberty and getting government out of your life is the way to go. But with that liberty comes responsibility. And the United States has been great over the last 250 years because we have been responsible with the power and the liberty that we have here in a way that's generous to other nations to help them see a beacon of light in us, but also not just by example, but to help liberty spread throughout the world. And we are in a battle right now with China to dominate influence in the world. We're not imperialistic. And that's the great thing about the United States is we've never been imperialistic.
That's what I mean about restraining its use. We could march across the planet.
We absolutely could. And the great thing about us is we don't want that. We want to be we want to let other nations self-determine how they actually use their liberty in a way that is still morally correct. And that's the key is if we're fighting a battle of influence with China, China is amoral at best, probably immoral in a lot of ways. And when they come into a country, they restrain it. And they bring in an influence that squashes innovation and squashes independence and squashes liberty. When we have influence, economic or foreign diplomacy or militarily around the world, we actually advance liberty and we leave people in a better state than when we found them.
The Artemis mission, its critics could say, why are we spending this kind of money when we're $39 trillion in debt? That's a fair question. But I want your thoughts on this. I believe that a nation's prestige has an impact on its ability to shape events in the world. And if we don't gain the prestige of overcoming the technological challenges to explore space, the Chinese will. And they will use that prestige not for the good that the United States tries to use its prestige, but for the malign intent that they have with respect to their view of the world. Your thoughts?
That's right. It's the difference between an expenditure and an investment. So the same dollars that go out from the federal government could be either categorized as an expenditure or an investment. In this case, I think the Artemis II is an investment. It's going to have a return on, we're going to get a return on that investment that is both economic and non-economic around the globe. 100% agree with you on that. And the scientific knowledge we're going to gain out of this, just like in our past space explorations, you look back at what happened in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and what we learned.
And look at this equipment in this room,
yes,
which I can point to. I can show you a chain going all the way back to Apollo on the things that happened in Apollo that made possible what we're doing right here today.
Yeah, we've got an inherent innovative spirit and entrepreneurial spirit in the United States. And if we don't allow that to grow and to find ways to push ourselves beyond the boundaries of what we thought was possible, then that spirit will die. China doesn't have that spirit, by the way. That's one of the big advantages we have over them is their people have been oppressed for all their entire lives. They do not have a spirit of innovation. They have a spirit of responding to what their government says they have to do. And that is much different. When we release that innovative spirit, there is no limit to what we can achieve as a nation because we have a just and moral goal. And we're doing it in a just and moral way. And again, back to the Artemis deal, I think it's an investment that will bring lots of value to the taxpayer long term. It is not just an expenditure.
The minute we have left, we still, if you're going to invest money, you have to have money, and yeah, we are borrowing money at a prodigious rate. Give me 1 minute on how that gets fixed.
Yeah, it gets fixed when folks around the country are willing to back their member of Congress up in reducing spending, mandatory and discretionary. Mandatory is what's killing us right now, particularly health care. We have got to go in there and not just take care of fraud, waste, and abuse, but we have got to cut government spending greatly over the next decade. And those will not be easy answers, and we've got to have political backup from our constituents that all say, I'm willing to give up some of the spending that's coming to me. Everybody has to be willing.
To what degree will economic growth help us get out of the box?
It'll definitely help us. And the one big, beautiful bill is going to create that growth and plus $1.6 trillion in reduced spending, the biggest spending cut in American history we passed last year.
Nathaniel Moran, a congressman from the 1st District of Texas. I really, really appreciate the time. I think we've had a nice discussion here today.
Thanks, Paul.
And I think all of us can say we appreciate the hard work you do in East Texas, and we appreciate the fact that you work so hard to represent us. And thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
In Focus is a weekly public affairs program featuring members of the local community working to make East Texas a better place. In Focus is produced by KTBB and the Team Sports Radio. And we thank you for listening. Join us again next week.